This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I have an epigraph from an interview that Spivak recently gave, which is just two sentences. Only capital and data globalize, all the rest is damage control. So the three words of our Winter Theory Institute, American World Literature, do not appear frequently in the Wilhelm Flusser lexicon. Yet Flusser, the perpetually unsettled, philosophically oriented Czech Brazilian writer who lived, just for some context, from 1920 to 1991, might be an ideal exemplar for a particular form of American world literature understood as the nexus of these three distinct conceptual problems. What I have in mind for American world literature is less a specific patriotic container and even less a market for some worthy literature in an age of U.S.-American hegemony, and more a belated sense of a need, and maybe thinking of your presentation, Tracy, a transmission and reception for methodological orientations for a kind of mobile theory auteur or wayward literatus in a plastic and assimilable age, which is one of Flusser's phrases. Flusser belongs to a generation of literary drift, exemplified also by Paul de Man, almost his exact contemporary. I'm going to get to this comparison a bit later in my talk. American world literature following the Flusserian variant is a sort of constellation of the long now, as if thrown onto a hemispheric ceiling by a planetarium projector, to use sort of an image that's congenial to Flusser. So moving from inside out, first world is foremost a matter of telematics and geophysical orientation and disorientation, not geopolitical accident for Flusser. Second, perhaps the most difficult issue, in my view, for this seminar and for Flusser as well, literature naming a critical problem of value around the necessity of reading and writing in post-history, which for Flusser is a way of talking about the future. Third, America, which Flusser connects gesturally to gluttonous contiguity on life support as a kind of endless information feed. And here we might conceive of life, as de Man puts it, quote, not just in biological but also in temporal terms, as the special ability to forget whatever precedes a present situation. As de Man wrote of literature and modernity and history, it is not at all certain that literature and American and world are in any way compatible concepts. The trouble with the term American is familiar. To make a somewhat stale point, it's not a sobriquet for just one political entity, the USA, but also designates various pluralities on two contiguous continents and various proximate lands. A hemisphere, half a world brain, the word designates a force field of reception, a form of quasi-nationalism attached to semi-formed, even inchoate desires. Flusser, who spent much of his three decades in Brazil, following his expulsion from Europe, writing in English and trying to crack open the door of the North American academic world, was suspicious of nationalist hypostasis in all forms, and was particularly wary of the form of nationalism in the U.S. Despite its, quote, many fluttering flags and virulent strains of patriotism, Flusser wrote, the North American continent seems to be the only place on earth which has been spared nationalism stricto sensu, Flusser wrote in a book called The History of the Devil, which I'll talk a bit about, from 1965. The devil here does not equal America, I should say. This book, which is his Portuguese opus, is at once a philosophical fable and a kind of theoretical novel about the principle of history told through the seven deadly sins, and the injunction to move beyond the impasses of ontology into methodological layers of a multi-stratified present. Nationalism for Flusser is displaced lust, quote, lust elevated to the level of social reality, he says. A sublimated romantic discourse for organizing collectivity through an unthinking relation to the sham fixities of blood and soil. Schools serve as incubators for softening humans into habitual stupidities in literature and all other discourses, for Flusser, as if insulating them into warm blankets. And this is the comparison he makes again and again. The history of humanity, he writes, is reduced to a monotonous series of fights between peoples intercalated by brief proofs of superiority of our own people or by events that prove how our people in their innocence have been exploited. By mid-century, writes Flusser, the romantic explosions of the past have subsided, but now the flakes of nationalism fall like radioactive ashes on a burning planet. Flusser likens what he sees across the Americas to gluttony, or else its negative image, hunger. The Americanization of the world, he wrote, provides a format that overwhelms access by swallowing everything and vomiting forth techne everywhere. Here's his longer quote. Inhabitants so preoccupied devouring their products that spill out, and they don't, they're so preoccupied devouring their products spilling out of machines that they don't have the opportunity to open their mouths to sing proper patriotic hymns in the praise of the people. The lust for nationalisms belongs to a decaying past, prettified kitsch, lackluster hymns and parades. The gluttony of the new continents spanning things belong to the future. Quote, the furious advance of technology will soon catch up with the population's growth curve and transform material misery into a mental misery of boredom and nausea. Before the authoritarian turn of the late 60s, Brazil, at least for a while, seemed to Flusser like a place full of potentialities, ready for new non-Eurocentric codes and primed for a search for new forms of communication. And here, communication is a technical term for Flusser, and I think Society for Critical Exchange might sort of be a good approximation of what he means. He means by communication theory. The literary theoretical aspect of communications. He explicitly opposes to communication theory as practiced in the U.S. As sort of a kind of natural science. It is instead, he writes, concerned with the human being's unnatural aspects, making a pressing connection developed elsewhere by Lyotard and more recently by Negrestani. Flusser notes that the American term humanities best underscores that the human being is an unnatural animal. And this was a sort of quote that I thought a bit about. Basically, for Flusser, things understood as technological things, but also writ large, is sort of one quadrant of a Venn diagram. Life is another, and the human is sort of in the overlap. And maybe humanities captures this because it has the suffix for him, but he doesn't really explain that. So his intellectual biography, which he wrote in German as he left Brazil in 1972 for good and went to France, in this intellectual biography, he remembers fleeing the gas chambers 30 years earlier and throwing himself into a dialogical project greedy for, quote, new, humane, and unprejudiced orientations to the inhuman, searching for a new code for a future Heimat that transforms or could transform adventure into habit, and thereafter the hallowings of habit into a residue that remained charged with excitement. So this is sort of how he conceived of a project. The network once woven, he hoped, would remain open to dialogue. So here you'll see the sort of idea of some kind of society for critical exchange. For example, a philosophical, this is Flusser's imagining what this would look like. For example, a philosophical institute in which Italian students of Croce, German Heidegger scholars, Portuguese followers of Ortega, Jewish positivists from Eastern Europe, Belgian Catholics, and Anglo-Saxon pragmatists took part, this institute had to open itself up as well to Japanese students of Buddhism, Lebanese mystics, and Chinese literary scholars. and it had to make room for Talmudists from Western Europe as well. And one interesting thing about Wilhelm Flusser is that his cousin was David Flusser, who is sort of a somewhat well-known religious studies scholar in Israel. So Flusser imagined taking part in a decades-long project, a second modernism that would attempt to synthesize the Brazilian culture out of a mixture of Western and Eastern European, African, East Asian, and Indian cultural elements. So much for Flusser's America. According to Flusser's atlas, the world, understood as the Earth's flattened surface, had become increasingly uncanny. You cannot, Flusser writes, feel at home in any of its projections. In effect, actual maps, this is me, work like Google Earth for Flusser long before that's a technical possibility. What you see, he writes, is, quote, not history marked as lines, but history hacked into chunks. Rather than showing a film, a sequence of photographs is presented. It offers not a procedural, but a quantified view. The flow of history becomes a mass of grains of sand. It was already impossible to capture the connections between geographically separate regions. Flusser's History of the Devil contrasts this weak, almost skin-like atlas and any affirmative commandments to describe superficial matter upon it with a more deeply situated layer available for methodological speculation. At once artificial construct and natural feature, Flusserian multidimensional space is material media topology, a strong mediator extending far back in space and way back in time. Characteristically, Flusser pushes to the bottom rather than down from the top. The subterranean cave, for example, functions in Flusserian writing as a paleo dwelling place, a ground zero for the art world. The arena, and this I was thinking of your comments about theory, the arena works as a site for staging personae before audiences seated on steps that resemble strata cut into the earth. The table outside the theater is not only the place where assorted business gets brokered, but also alludes to another interface of geophysical mediation, the subterranean water table and hidden conduits for sedimented drift. And here, Benjamin's essays on Naples and the idea of porosity, I think, resonates. So these tropes from stratigraphy, in effect, serve as fossilized technical images that give objective inhuman character to aesthetic agencies over deep time, deep epochal time spans. Technical images, Flusser writes, quote, liberate their receivers as if by magic from the necessity of thinking conceptually, at the same time replacing historical consciousness and the ability to think conceptually with programs and algorithms. Ezra Pound's particular relevance to the genesis of this strain of Flusser's media theory is worth noting. I'm happy to talk later about this somewhat improbable genealogy. We were talking before about sort of Blumian strong vates, or however you say that word, and Pound is definitely one for Flusser through McLuhan, which is a little bizarre. This link, though, depends on his formulation of the image, Pound's that is, the image and the ideogram as a time-based metamedium, to adopt Julian Murfitt's world, in which words and photographic images both became photographic and printed at the same time. The Chinese written character as a medium for poetry, for instance, highlights a certain kind of metamedial technicity from which Flusser derived his concept of the technical image. This is Pound, it's Fenollosa actually, but here it is. In what sense can verse written in terms of visible hieroglyphics be reckoned true poetry? It might seem that poetry, which, like music, is a time art, weaving its unities out of successive impressions of sound, could with difficulty assimilate a verbal meaning medium consisting largely of semi-pictorial appeals to the eye. So this is Pound. Reading backwards from Flusser to Pound, or more accurately to Pound's idiosyncratic adoption of Fenollosa, this involves special attention to the ways media mediates spatially and temporally, and mediates spatial and temporal unevenness in particular, and conceptual simultaneity. Epochal possibilities of media relations before alphabetic culture, to put it into a Flusserian framework, more specifically. In effect, the cave, the table, and the arena serve as complex anthropogenic artifacts of human perspective for Flusser. I would also note a key point that Boris Groys makes, that the invisible part of the technical image, the hidden part addressed with metadata, is assigned a real place somewhere, territorialized, inscribed in a hidden database. And that's really an important point for Flusser, that there's a phenomenology of the hidden, which is how Groys would put it, that it's not the endless procession of signs, that somewhere unavailable to us is a trove of data. So there's a problem of access to that data. While it's true that anyone's experience may designate seemingly random personal reminiscences from one's own personal life, the appearance of these scattered details is less directed towards fashioning a unique or even coherent biographical foundation for any position than it is dragging a biographical database through methodological throughput of technical affordances, situating the human as a kind of form factor in deep time. This is sort of spinning off of Flusser's ideas. The word strata, Flusser often notes, means levels, as in layers of rock in the ground or superimposed coats of paint. And it also shares, as Flusser points out, an etymology with the word strategy, in the sense that strategy is something spread out or distributed. More than a scattered array of miscellaneous literary, historical, and biographical characters, Flusser's archive leaves us with a stratigraphy of mixed media, surfaces, contexts, scenes, hazards, risk positions that determine, oblige, and configure concrete research strategies and aesthetic projects. These might be best described, following Flusser, as mediation zones for critical creative work across temporal interfaces. When it comes to strategic orientations, the heap of levels is less about broken images for composing private stories or dramas than smoldering boundary stones. Devising methodologies amid the waste or the detritus resembles what Flusser calls projectivities, projects and project-driven activities across multiple interfaces rather than subjectivities. And this is, again, one of the things he hammers again and again. Projectivities, not subjectivities. What emerges, as Flusser writes, will no longer be found in any place or time, but projected in imagined surfaces that absorb geography and history. The deep time media theoretical approach, as the German media theorist Siegfried Zielinski notes, engages strata as a treasure trove of possibilities, or perhaps potentialities, which permanently have to be explored every day and every day new. From this point of view, the strata of the remote past provide both a critical destination and a creative point of departure for a tremendously stocked storehouse of experience and experiment. Following Pound, whose writings Flusser carefully annotated, which I've seen, it's at the Akademie der Kunst in Berlin. So, of course, no Flusser scholar cares about Pound, and no Pound scholar cares about Flusser. But there are the books, and there are very, very detailed notes, which are sort of a bizarre reading of Pound that I can't really get anyone to care about. But there it is. Following Pound, Flusser traces a drift from the technical image to the traditional image, and he traces this back to the Paleolithic. And this is going to get into some really wacky anthropology, but here it goes. About 40,000 years ago, no doubt in a cave in southwestern Europe, the subject withdrew further into its subjectivity to get an overview of the objective circumstances. Yeah, stuff. The earliest image makers known to us in Lascaux fixed their observation on the walls of caves to make them accessible to others and to us as well. That is, they acted, for hands are required for this fixing, and did so in a new way, inasmuch as they used their hands to grasp objects, these aurochs, these bulls, but to also manipulate surfaces to represent objects, these bulls. They sought symbols, and the activity was about symbols. From the imaginative consciousness came the universe of traditional images of symbolic content the universe that would henceforth serve as a model for manipulating the environment. That is, it sort of encouraged them to project themselves out into the world and go hunt bulls. And one curious thing about this sort of bizarre anthropology is it's something that Pound writes about quite a bit. So at some point he calls it the Paleolithic vortex. And I'm fairly convinced that Flusser got this from Pound. So methodological speculation for Flusser begins here with hunting and gathering the image 40,000 years ago, the same temporal order of magnitude that interested Pound. Only very recently, in the last few thousand years, as it were, came fitful efforts to cultivate or tame the image, efforts Flusser connects, for better or for worse, to the advent of literary humanism. Before writing, this is Flusser again, during the 40,000-year period of so-called prehistory, other media, especially pictures, carried information. And even during the relatively brief period when texts were dominant, images continued to be effective, dialectically challenging the dominance of texts. And so one is tempted to say that linear texts have played only an ephemeral role in the life of humans, that history was only a diversion, and that we are now in the process of turning back to two-dimensionality, into the imaginary, magical, and mythical. Flusser says he wants to resist these temptations, the lure of imagination, subjectivity, and originality in particular, and makes a crucial point that returns us to a version of experiment embedded in fields of relationships, as he puts it, with a multimediated project seated outside an ancient arena. In this experimental paleofuturism, the technical image isn't a return to images that depict observations of objects per se, but an opening for the computations of new media concepts confronted with inhuman scales of contingency. In a sustained engagement with Flusser, Zielinski underscores the conjunctions of experience and experiment as a way past the current impasse concerning epistemology and ontology after post-structuralism. The Flusser archive was entrusted to Zielinski following Flusser's death, and it serves not only as a repository of Flusser's life work, which Flusser wrote in four languages, and it's basically evenly divided between English, French, Portuguese, and German. So one of the things I'll talk about later is the belatedness of Flusser's theoretical reception. Partly had to do with that he wrote in four languages, and that he was constantly retranslating his work to attempt to engage various audiences. So that the works are different. So this archive is also a portable laboratory of cultural techniques, according to Zielinski. Zielinski's project is to actualize the latent potential of dead media, which according to Zielinski, he calls this project variantology, the imaginary sum of all possible genealogies of media phenomena. Following Flusser, American world literature presents a problem of paleofuturist orientation, an 11th hour bid for relevancy of reading and writing in the information age. It's been recorded. American world literature presents a problem of paleofuturist orientation. So the pull back and forth, an 11th hour bid for relevancy of reading and writing in the information age. And one of Flusser's really important books is called Does Writing Have a Future? Paleofuturism isn't so much my coinage, but a found word object from the techno trash heap. Paleo, which means way back, turns out to share etymological origins with another Greek root that interested Flusser, tele, which means far away. Both tele and paleo convey deep orientations, so scales beyond the human, making ways to faraway space and time, respectively. There's also a curious connection between these Greek etonyms and other affiliated words from the East, from Tamil in particular. And Flusser's very interested in this particular problem where you orient to the light, which involves turning to the East. So two of the few concept words shared in the West and East, other than those associated with transfers of artifactual objects or sounds that babies make, for Flusser. Tele and paleo. Far away and way back as a sustained intellectual and aesthetic project, as for a society of critical exchange. Here I want to highlight a continuity with the Benjaminian sense of rescuing the past. Don't give up on your desire for a better past is itself a constellation of experiment. Critical experiment here means finding, searching for aesthetic intellectual opportunities. In Zelinsky's sense, he even describes this as a kind of excellence. This methodological injunction is deeply project-oriented, a cultura experimentalis, Zelinsky likes to call it, against the idea of disposable time, the garbage time of the now. The approach instead foregrounds dreamers and modelers, and Zelinsky's sort of most prominent work, which was published by MIT about 10 years ago, is called Deep Time of the Media. And so he's really interested in returning to the past to find instances of failed media projects as a theoretical resource. So not simply to write a history of the past, but to look at what these people were trying to do. So there are chapters on efforts to hear into other rooms. And what was the idea of this? It's a great book. So don't seek the old in the new, Zelinsky writes. Seek something new in the old, something excellent way back, encounters with novelty amidst waste. Against the call for cultura experimentalis, in the critical situation now, going deeper often means reading less or sometimes nothing at all. Surface reading, that's what I'm thinking about in particular. To show you what I mean, I'm going to pluck something from my media feed from last year. It appeared accidentally. The Double Life of Paul DeMond by Evelyn Barish, 20 years in the making, finally hitting bookstores. The octogenarian author of this biography retired from academia in the mid-90s, spent her declining years on a definitive and dutifully joyless dirt dump on DeMond. She took on the project just after the revelations broke about DeMond's wartime writing in Nazi-occupied Belgium. This is from an interview. "I want to go deeper," she says, "and actually understand what he had done." Her biography covers the first 41 years of DeMond's life, the part that doesn't matter, as it were. The rough draft. The part that ends as he finishes his PhD, which is Mallarmé, Yeats, and the post-romantic predicament. Just before he embarks on his professorial career in earnest at Cornell, 6 years before deconstruction, 6 years before DeMond becomes interesting, as it were. It's probably not news to this group, but DeMond had an unusual CV. His first book, Blindness and Insight, only appeared in 1971, and it's interesting to think about how late in his career a book appeared. According to one highly exercised Amazon reviewer who either got his hands on an advanced copy of the Barish biography or is lying in the review, the reviewer says that he read, or she read, it's unclear, read 560 pages of this biography in one sitting. And who can do that? I don't know. That according to this reviewer, Barish did a staggering amount of research for the book, talked to everyone, and labored in all the archives. And in interviews, she describes the drudgery, this the sheer unpleasantness of the work, of hundreds of personal interviews and returning to Belgium with 54 boxes of papers, piles of yellow printed matter on her dining room table in her New York apartment, which she drapes in a sheet. And this particular image appears in a few interviews. It looked like a corpse, she said. There it was, the second lifeless body. The curious thing for me is that for all her labors over DeMond's corpse, she doesn't have any inclination to read the actual corpus, the 22 boxes archived in Irvine. This is what she says. "In another lifetime, I would have gotten hold of more of it. In many ways, I don't understand any of it. To me, it's just a waste of time." A waste of time. This is someone who spent her retirement sifting through heaps of elapsed and forgotten letters in search of the fascist penetralium that motivates a writer she finds otherwise impenetrable. Not, this is my argument also for Derrida, that Nazis have better ways of communicating, more efficacious media modalities. than through deconstruction. The de Man biography is of one piece of a pervasive ontology of what Fleischer would call retropresentism, which I'll return to later in the talk. As I hinted earlier, as a wayward literatus, de Man might be usefully compared with Flusser. Both were World War I babies. They were born just 5 months apart, after armistice in Antwerp and Prague, respectively, each from a cultural capital of a vexed minority language. De Man was Francophone Flemish, Flusser, a German-speaking Jew. Both were members of cosmopolitan, polyglot, and polymath families, and it wouldn't take an extreme Hegelian to notice that both represent a certain thwarted trans-European literary, academic, intellectual ambition. Both became exiles and migrants. De Man, who was not Jewish, it should be observed, claimed to have been turned back from Spain on the last train out, as it were, in 1940, and eventually emigrated to New York in 1948. Flusser, who was Jewish and lost his entire family in the death camps, and first he escaped and managed to get a position at the London School of Economics, then realized his family was in jeopardy, went back to Prague and got out a second time, made it to Sao Paulo eventually. Both had visa issues, literary, intellectual ones, linked to the fitful transmission of incomplete European academic credentials across the Atlantic, difficulty placing themselves in new institutional academic bureaucratic contexts. Flusser began his literary academic career only belatedly in 1960 when he began work with the Brazilian Institute for Philosophy. Belated is a decisive factor, and I think one really important issue for us to think about, I mean us in the profession to think about, is the belatedness of the reception of this particular kind of writing across all sorts of national frontiers. When do people start reading Bakhtin? Why does Benjamin arrive when he does? And why is Flusser's reception always already belated? So the experience of both de Man and Flusser, their respective decisions to flee, comes with disorienting failed telos, an experience not yet experienced, in Flusser's words, of the unanticipated human horror of camps. Flusser himself derives a useful concept from this connection, Bodenlosigkeit. So his intellectual biography is called Bodenlos, which he connects to his own intellectual efforts to hybridize experience and experiment. The word Bodenlosigkeit is frequently translated, mistranslated, it's too bad Emily's gone, as rootlessness. This translation follows a familiar account that figures the intellectual as a deracinated, wandering stranger, someone without roots, Wurzeler roots. But Flusser explicitly rejects the ethnic, racial, identitarian organicism here, the notion of roots. The word he employs conveys something quite different. Boden means ground, artificial or otherwise. The surface built or unbuilt for putting things upon. The bottom, the floor, the staging area, and the depth charge. The horizontal plane which interrupts the vertical axis is a hallucinatory membrane. What is the meaning of a self without base? Flusser asks in Bodenlos, the philosophical autobiography I referenced earlier. Bottomlessness. He describes Bodenloskeit as a hybrid of concept and experience, a concept in which experience dwells, albeit temporarily, and then is done. It is, in effect, for Flusser, the conceptual laboratory. Elsewhere in his writings, he links the idea of the requisite ruination of concepts like homeland. He links this to that. Human beings may settle and dwell, but in the end, they lack homeland. They lack Heimat. He uses this particular German word, Heimat, across the languages. And the work of negating Heimat is critically and technically significant for him. The idea calls to mind Benjamin's line in the Storyteller essay about the generation that came back from World War I, experientially homeless. This is Benjamin. A generation that had gone to school on a horse-drawn streetcar now stood under the open sky in a countryside in which nothing remained unchanged but the clouds. And beneath these clouds, in a field of force, destructive torrents and explosions, was the tiny, fragile human body. So that's what I think the form factor of the human. The form of the human. Benjamin subtly alludes to the German word for homelessness, Obdachlosigkeit, being under the open sky, literally being without a roof. Flusser, who was a full generation younger than Benjamin and thus went to school on electric streetcars, modifies the concept somewhat. Obdachlosigkeit becomes Bodenlosigkeit. Instead of experience without a roof, we have experience without a floor. To be unsettled, one first has to be settled, Flusser writes. And this, in a way, is his methodological credo. The disassociation of experience and experiment, which Benjamin foretells in the Storyteller essay, has become calcified with a post-World War II consensus that systematically shackles an unmovable triad, state, corporation, citizen, to the fluid uncertainties of finance and work. And I want to argue that this is partly where we have to locate American world literature. On the one hand, experience becomes fungible. It accumulates, passes by, and is communicated or distributed. But such a comprehension of experience also falls partly into the trap of linear developmental and historical progression of thought, as Flusser points out, where the object was to gather one experience after another. In this sense, experience is always packaged in the past tense as junk, as cultural space is allocated for discarding experience as so much rubbish. On the other hand, Experiment seems to disavow precarity, since it presupposes security. Yet Flusser insists on occupying experimental precarity, being without Heimat, so to speak, because he writes, he learned that too many Heimats dwelled within him. Heimat is not some eternal or immutable quality, he discovered, but a technology, a comfortable, historically convenient error for confusing the private self and the entire world. Prague is crumbling. I am crumbling. It is an ontological error, he writes. That this error is felt acutely by the migrant longing for a particular smell, and he always brings up stew meat braised in cream, so the desire to smell this, does not change its status as an erroneous form of retro-presentism. Flusser clarifies, the search for the lost Heimat, Heimweh, homesickness, is the equivalent of prejudice rooted in place. The Francophone nostalgie only conveys loss. Only the Portuguese word, saudade, he writes, in which similar experience exposes dizzying prismatic possibilities, is multivalent and critical enough to please Flusser. So part of Flusser's interest is learning to read across languages. Here we see the beginnings of Zelinsky's idea of variantology. In the opening pages of Bodenlos, Flusser notes the absurd narcissism of the self considered a plucked flower in a vase, unavailable for replanting, and so on. Instead, he positions bottomlessness as a critical orientation, not a stance, but better an instance, an approach to necessary methodological risk positioning. A search without ground for a situation in which, quote, culture can be experimentally realized in terms of alternative possibilities. For Flusser, these experimental possibilities begin with a migrant's linguistic frustration when language becomes opaque, denaturalized, technical, as a means for navigating alien environments. He describes this approach as bodenlos Dasein. What's more, it's an encounter with the baselessness of ontology in all forms, and as such, it's the target of the exercise in critical irony, which is this theoretical novel, The History of the Devil, which proceeds from experimental premise that is also the migrant literate's hard-won and seemingly dizzying conclusion. Nothingness forms the bedrock of reality. That's sort of the payoff of The History of the Devil. The crucial pivot leads us into technical media and Flusser's treatise on the vampire squid from hell. So this is the one work where he really tried to translate it into as many languages as he could, and it came late when he returned to France and started meeting Deleuze and Glissant and Baudrillard and Virilio. So he wrote this book, which is called Vampirotoithis Infernalis. And it's simultaneously a sort of a bestiary about this strange tentacled life form and his theory of the media system. and I'll explain how that works in a second. It's a curious anatomy of both the media system and this deep ocean invertebrate. Once again, method involves going deeper into depthlessness, plumbing depths without bottoms. He who fights with monsters should look to it that he himself does not become a monster. And when you gaze long into the abyss also gazes into you. Demonstrations, monsters, the common denominator is, of course, the Latin verb monstrare, to show. And Flusser wants to change the game of media studies, swapping in shown for where shown from was. Among its other merits, The Vampire Squid Book is a fable about plunging into the depthless hell of media history. How can you write a history of media if you don't understand media very narrowly? Have a definition that includes cave paintings. So for counsel about possible futures, it proposes fantastic convergences that link the odd existence of this tentacled life form, complexly equipped for probing the deep ocean, to the inhuman consequences of our emerging system of new media. Humans increasingly approximate the strategies of squid, Flusser writes. Here's a quote. As our interest in objects begins to wane, we create media that have enabled us to rape the brain, forcing them to store brains, that is, immaterial information. We have built chromatophores of our own, televisions, videos, computer monitors that display synthetic images with whose help broadcasters of information can seduce their audiences. So recumbent with chromatophoric gadgets, you know, and he really makes a point of that our brains are now becoming part of our warmed bellies as we have our machines. Probing and probed by and propelled through an endless immaterial ooze, increasing our environment is, for Flusser in so many words, the seemingly unfathomable abyss fitfully plumbed by algorithms. His ideas also confront the technically assisted observation of a reality anterior to the emergence of the human species, or even anterior to every recognized form of life on Earth, as Maya Suk characterizes it. The archaic fossil, as Maya Suk puts it, is clearly rooted in modern knowledge of inhuman timescales advanced by geology and plate tectonics. This is also a fossil of the future, designating the material support on the basis of which the experiments that yield estimates of ancestral phenomena proceed. For example, an isotope whose rate of radioactive decay is known, or the luminous emission of a star that informs us as to the date of its formation. So the technical assisted probing of the universe is for Flusser related to this strange life form. Such ersatz archives are not merely eccentric, they exit the orbit of human scale altogether. Seeing and hearing by technical means, devising techniques of observation, experiment, and reflection is the crux of what Zielinski sees as Flusser's media philosophy, and also the lodestone of his own project of variantology. Proudly claiming Flusser as his past master, Zielinski seeks to transform the bottomless abyss of expired databases, dated theories, and dead links into a kind of experimental practice. The bottomless abyss becomes a pile of possibilities. This method self-consciously tumbles forward rather than looking backward. Dead ends, losers, and inventions that never made it into material product have important stories to tell, Zielinski writes. The stories are written in the spirit of Flusser as a history of the devil, explicitly opposing positivist teleology. The point of experimental paleofuturism isn't just to look forward rather than backwards, but to resuscitate or resituate the new against the past as an experimental lab of discontinuity and interruption. Methodological nomadicism, in other words, isn't a hindrance, but both a goal and a working method for understanding how new media determines our situations, modulating in effective and aesthetic terms, to modify Kittler somewhat, as well as reroute our spatial and temporal positioning. Describing the genealogy of this approach, Zielinski notes his disaffection from the idea of technological telos. This is Zielinski. I doubted very much that our epoch embodied the great possibilities of progress in the history of civilization. If one used diversity, the richness of variety in existing things, forms, technique, arts, etc., as any criteria for progress. And here you can see Gould, Stephen Jay Gould sort of filtering into Zelensky's sense of a different way of thinking of progress through a different way of thinking of evolution. That would value diverse, let's say, diversity of approach or means. To be different, divergent, changing, alternating, and alternative are alternative translations from the Latin variare. Instead, this method works on an XY axis, one through the verticality of phenomena and processes, which means, in effect, the attempt to get to the bottom of things, and the other characterized by the conceptual dance on plateaus. Significantly, Zelensky credits not Deleuze but Flusser for teaching him the merit of abandoning the romantic search for the absolute in all things and embracing the cunning of fortuitous finds. It might make sense to consider this approach as an inhumanist corollary to Althusser's point that history is a process without a subject, that the subject of the process of modernity sounds something like the inhuman. This problem carries strong undertones of Foucault, especially his late interest in documenting the fate of human identities in dispersion and abstention. When Lyotard posits the inhuman as the hidden subject of humanism, he cites this line of Apollinaire: "More than anything, artists are men who want to become inhuman." I'd like to connect this observation with Lyotard's boldly counterintuitive claim that proposes postmodernism as modernism's larval state. "A work can become modern only if it's first postmodern," Lyotard writes. This statement and paleofuturism itself is shot across the bow of the false epochal closure of modernity, and the contextual historicism and narrow periodization that so often prevails and contains critical thinking today. Framed by ex-anthropic extremity on both sides, critical inhumanism is a matter of excess and intensity, expanded hermeneutics, weird fictions, inhuman satires, burlesques of situated and fixed identities. As such, it emerges from what Negrestani terms the catastrophe of revision that erases fixed temporal orientations from the future by modifying the link between the past and the present. Building on this take on inhumanism, the literary zone itself provides a kind of inhuman scalar orientation for method, a darkly comic orientation through the inhuman world. All right, so here's my effort to connect all this to the seminar. This institute is very much an exercise in thinking about enormous subjects. Gigantomachy, a struggle for conceptual profundity between concepts in an age in which these kind of projects no longer seem legit. I wish to pull another conversation into this gravitational vortex of American world literature, namely the current discourse about the so-called ontological turn that so often comes bundled with the conclusion that criticism has run out of steam, to borrow Latour's title, which I referred to earlier. Oddly, this move frequently gets further coupled with calls for new critical humility and special antipathy to the literary critical work associated with the lessons of post-structuralism. For instance, Rita Felski's new book, The Limits of Critique, argues for the necessity of a post-critical approach that borrows from Latour's actor network theory, a format that somehow shows us how everything is connected without epistemology. And Felski's variety provides a strong positive value emphasis for the humanities in an age of austerity. Critical figure of the network has anything to do with the associated logic of capital and data must go unnoticed. The post-critical may now seem new and newly descriptive, but its very gesture to novelty, in this gesture the mask slips. As Groys writes, to ask about the new, whether this be new American studies, new materialism, new media, new humility, new realism, is tantamount to asking about value. Post-critical means value hunger and depends on the fantasy of authentic access to a continuous transcript of uninterrupted experience. Further, the new ontological turn is also of one piece, perhaps, of the idea of reality hunger put forward forcibly by David Shields in a manifesto of kind of a new critical amateurism in a much discussed essay called Reality Hunger. The polemic claims that literature now, understood as the novel, basically, or the great American novel, has dead-ended at an impasse between, roughly speaking, reality and story. Citing a litany of contemporary literary figures at home on the American world literature circuit, and here I was thinking about Emily's point about the books that go through that sifting machine that end up in translations and other cosmopolitan centers. So that very real institutional form. This litany, in this litany, Shields comes down hard with a preference for reality, understood as messy space, over story, understood as ordered time. My descriptivism, your prescriptivism. My data, your platform. My irrelevant memoirs, your historicist novels. The miniaturization of all zones of attention, the endless vastness of the internet. Here as elsewhere, the rigidity of opposition seems critically misguided. Perversity in a time of American world literature is the dogmatic drumbeat for new critical modesty. In a sense, the formula also embargoes fabula in the name of sujet. Binarism returns with pleonastic vengeance, the post-historical echo chamber that redescribes an older aesthetic agon about format and character. And we talked about realism and romance, but I wonder if that sort of gets into this back and forth. American world literature functions as a matrix for something like database biography, the floating, quote, crazy umbrella self, which is how Shields describes his preferred literary form, versus the sheer ongoing procession of data there intact. Instead, Flesserian method works like a projector of experience and experiment. Just as for de Man, the capacity for unsettling concepts is critical, against the premature settlement of antagonisms, Flusser underscores the gesture of expulsion. He does so, he writes, to stress the extent of that the problem is not just about a new world of boat people, Palestinians, or Jewish immigrants, but also about the restless expulsion of the older generations from the world of their children and grandchildren through technologies, and the expulsion of humanists from the world of apparatus. The expulsion of humanists from apparatus follows from the arrival expulsion as a condition of being in the world, primarily organized by the exchange and interaction with information, as Flusser writes, in which humans and things, that is, technology, cannot be easily disaggregated. Flusser is not celebrating exile here, promoting it as a voluntary path to so-called truth, because those persons expelled from their homes are likely not greeted as critical observers of the culture of their new homes, but are often abused, hated, and detained in murderous prisons that are themselves apparatus. Every shift of dimensionality involves expulsion from habit, exposure to invisible agencies and hidden mechanisms of value. Following Flusserian definitions of American world literature, then, is an act of expanded hermeneutics. Thank you very much.